Hello, Indigenous Earthlings. Here we are again, seven revolutions later, balancing into another Express Yourself. I'm Raleigh Burley, taking the reins for today's show. You're listening to By the Time I Get to Arizona off the latest album from Latin funk collective Brownout. The album is called Fear of a Brown Planet, a psychedelic reworking of Public Enemy's Fear of a Black Planet. Brownout performs at Belly Up tomorrow night with Money Chicha. Stay tuned for an interview with Beto Martinez, founding member of the band, and Cadian K's Luke Nessler. But first, we hear a conversation between Hawk Newsom, president of Black Lives Matter of Greater New York, and the Reverend Dr. Gerald Durley, who marched with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Both attended Our Day 2018 in Snowmass this month, and Cadian K's Amy Haddon Marsh sat with them over a lunch break as they spoke about the movement and issues facing people of color in the United States. Here are clips from that conversation.
He can tell you who he is. Let him tell you who he is.
I'm
Hawk.
Oh, thank you. All right, CJ.
HAWKNEWSOME. I'm the president of Black Lives Matter of Greater New York.
I'm Gerald Durley. I don't know where to start. I marched with Dr. King in 59 and 69. I'm chairman of the board of what we call Interfaith Power and Light throughout America in 40 states, 22,000 congregations. But I was the dean of Clark, the dean of Morehouse School of Medicine. All of that stuff. White House, I traveled with Barack in 2007 to try to fight some of the same thing that he's doing.
I'm learning.
You know, Hawk, you said that Black Lives Matter is about black liberation, and I immediately thought of, you know, Stokely Carmichael and Black Panthers and all of those guys. What's the difference now?
I don't see too many differences now, except now we have technology. Right now you don't have to be present or catch it on TV to see what's being said in another place. Now we can organize more effectively across the country. When we talk about black liberation, we talk about these movements. You talk about Stokely Carmichael, the Black Panthers, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
SCLC.
Exactly. And you see a lot of similarities in the way that the government treats us. Let's be perfectly honest. They were not fans of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. They called him a communist. He had all of the acronyms, FBI, CIA, all over him. Kind of similar to the way we have it now, but now he's dead. He's made progress. The same people who ostracized him and hated him now, back in the past, are looking at us saying, you need to be more like him. You know, it doesn't matter what time it is, you're going to dislike anyone who speaks up for the rights of black people. That's the American way. When we talk about black liberation, what does black liberation look like to me?
Mm-hmm.
Black people who own property in their own neighborhoods. We own the businesses. We in our neighborhoods, we control the politics in our own communities. Our lives are valued by the government. It's truly equity. I don't think racism can ever be completely exterminated, but we can eliminate systematic oppression. And that's what our black liberation mm-hmm. looks like to me.
Okay.
When we were in the movement, I didn't fight for equality. I knew I could never be equal in money with the Kennedys. I was a good ball player. I would never be equal with Michael Jordan. But we fought for parity, access. We were denied access so often. So we were fighting for the opportunity to give us access. As the great philosopher James Brown said, open up the door, I'll get it myself. So we were fighting to break down those doors so that we would have access. There's a difference between parity and equality. A 5'9" person can never have parity with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. But they can have parity to have access to be on the team. We were fighting for the team. And so that's what the movement was. We realized that we would never have on Wall Street, but don't deny us the opportunity. That's what we were fighting for, parity. So what are you saying with Black Lives Matter? The equality concept, that was our initiative, and we were willing to sacrifice and risk. If my mother got in my way, I would walk over my mother.
Right on. Right on.
I would walk over my mother, but my mother was astute enough to realize that this is the very DNA of my son. And you've got to step back and say, Mom, it's a different day. And we have to realize what they're doing and how they're doing it now. It's their time. But he said a key word, which the difference when we were doing this in 1959, 60, 64, and all that. Mm-hmm. And now he said a key word, which we have to look, social media.
Yeah.
Social media, they can rally 50,000 people in less than 10 minutes. We had Gestetner the machines, was typing on all of this.
When we were, mimeograph, you're talking about the mimeograph?
You know what I mean? And the biggest thing we saw was in 1961, January, we were getting ready to try to break down the transportation barriers. And so we were getting on a bus to go to Alabama, but we crossed the Alabama line to break down, you know, the transportation. Now, when we got to Alabama, to Anderson, they turned the bus over, burned it and all this. The rest of the student body did not know about that until 9 o'clock the next morning.
Oh, wow.
From 10 o'clock that night to 8 o'clock the next morning, bus turned over, Thomas was beating up everybody. Now, while it's happening, it can be recorded.
Absolutely.
Which then generates a new kind of excitement.
Mm-hmm.
There, we say, oh, no, what happened? So mm-hmm. therein lies the difference. Mm-hmm. How they use that social media. And the excellent person for using social media, of course, is President Donald Frankenstein. He uses that media to try to build a greater man. And it's a... and see, Frankenstein has put this out there, but he knows how to use the media.
Absolutely.
And when they use the media, that we did not have that. We got, I mean, I'll never forget, J. Edgar Hoover was killing us through the media. We did not have access to the media. When Martin came out, the first thing I'll never forget, we were shocked when he said that he was a womanizer and doing this, and all they got to do is put it out. So now they can act and counteract.
Amen.
They can counter so effective. We couldn't do that. We just had to go deep down inside and get among ourselves and say, we will not quit. We go back.
It seems to me that that kind of activism might have been more effective. Do you think social media is as effective as...
It's effective in spreading the messaging.
Okay.
But what you have with social media, and I love your input on this, is everybody wants to be the next leader. Everybody wants to be that big leader. A lot of times people are showing up to marches, right? You look at some of the big marches, the March for Our Lives, and some of the other major marches, and people just show up.
Yeah.
We call them show-up parties.
Yeah.
There was no directives given. One of the most dangerous things that's happening right now in our country is we are telling people go vote and not trying to build a unified platform, not giving people things to demand from these politicians who want their votes. So back to social media, yes, it helps and we bring people out, but there's also a divisive culture.
Yeah.
Like, people won't support that mm-hmm. person because they're in a clique, and that person is outside of the clique, so we can't support what they're doing. It helps, but at the same time, you know, it hurts because people get caught up in their egos and being this personality, like, hey, I'm with Dr. Durley, selfie, we're at a movement. But that's part of it.
With them, they have a lot of latitudinal freedom. And I mean, when I was dean at Clark College in Atlanta, and it was coming around, they'd say, well, look, we'd like to come to the march, but what we're going to do, we're going to send our chapter president, and they can record it and send the recording back, not realizing what you're saying, that we need bodies.
Bodies.
We need bodies. But they could record it, send it back, and they could put their money together. I know when we were at the Million Man March with Farrakhan, that's my good buddy, born on the same day, May 11th.
Yeah.
And we had to have bodies. We had to have bodies and commitment. And but the National Association of Black Accountants, they said, we're going to send two people, and we're going to stream it live.
Right.
You can't stream things like that.
No.
So therein lies the other side.
Uh-huh.
Now, for getting the message across and getting the right kind of, that's excellent. And I have to tell my own son and my own daughter, you got to be there. You got to be willing to put, as the old folks say, you got to put some skin in the game.
Skin in the game.
Skin in the game. And that's why I guess I'm here now. I mean, I had to really make a lot of apologies last night and this morning to my son and my daughter.
Why? Mm-hmm.
Because they planned a surprise Father's Day message.
Mm-hmm.
All four of my grandchildren were there in Atlanta, and I left at 8 o'clock coming here. So I talked to them last night. But But it's just like with Abernathy, these kids, with C.T. Vivian. I don't know if you heard any C.T. Vivian. Mm-hmm. But C.T. was Martin's right hand.
Okay.
He's 94 now. Joe Lowry's 97. They live around the corner from me. We all live in the same neighborhood.
That's awesome.
And I go to them, and I say, what do we need to do here? Well, and it makes sense. It makes sense.
Yes, sir.
It makes sense. It's like, and I listen. I absorb it like a sponge. And so they said, and like Bernice, I got pictures. I'll show you Bernice King, Martin's daughter. We all know her together. And so when Bernice and I talked, Hosea Williams' daughter, Elizabeth Olami, they understood that their dads, Abernathy, had to be out on the front line. They understood that it was not an abdication of their responsibility nor a love of them,
Amen.
But there was something that had to be done. Everything is on time. I don't think we could have been effective as we were had we had social media.
Talk about that.
With social media, you can abdicate yourself. You cannot be there and learn everything that's there and be the and be speak more about it, and you weren't even there.
Yeah.
You can be an expert and not even be there.
Some people feel validated in just simply hitting share.
Yeah.
Or reposting an event or an issue, shedding light on something. They feel like their duty is fulfilled.
Yeah.
By speaking about it on social media, whereas in your day you had to show up,
yeah, you had
and
to be
actually
there.
Be there,
yeah,
yeah.
Like now, I don't have Twitter, I don't have Facebook, I don't have any of that. That's not a negative against technology. When it forces me to have to ask you a question, it forces me to have to talk to you. And anytime I ask a question, I grow. But if you're doing all of this and you're disconnected,
yeah,
and it's that kind of thing. Once people get a little platform. A little stated, they get too big to talk to the regular people that they're trying to lift.
Man,
they get to say, and I'm this, and I was with Mayor so-and-so, and I was with them.
Yeah.
And then they forget. And the real strength is what we're doing here.
Mm-hmm.
This is the strength
building.
Of the movement. And even at my age now, I'll sit and talk with one of those seniors. They can say, you know, I think rabbits jump. And I say, well, how high do they jump, Reverend Lowry?
Mm-hmm.
And he might say, what jump? He even forgot what he said.
Yeah.
But I love it
mm-hmm.
because I get that energy. And then I have a responsibility to pass that on.
Amen.
All of
Amen.
Us are nothing more than catalysts.
That's it.
That's all.
That's it.
And then when your time on the planet is up, it's up. But we got people want to hold on and want to get pats on the back and glorious this. And it says in the Bible, it says, humble yourself before the almighty hand of God, so that God might exalt you in different time. And
Amen.
When God exalts you, you can't be pulled down. But if you exalt yourself and you let people pat you on the, pretty soon the same ones who put you up
will take you down. You know, it's interesting. We get support in New York City. We get more respect than support. A lot of people don't stand with us because, I'm not going to lie to you, I wasn't a saint. You know,
mm-hmm.
I gave my life to God. I changed in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But they won't stand because of things I may have done in the past. They won't stand because they're like, what you do is you pull out your gun and you take shots at everybody.
Yeah.
So I respect what you're doing, but I can't stand it. What's made us stronger is the fact that people don't stand with it, because then we got to hustle. We have to be in those schools, right, where a lot of people aren't. We have to be in the streets. Our primary focus is black liberation, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of people had a problem with us taking that approach.
And
there's nobody who ordained me a leader. I didn't call myself a leader until the press said it, right?
Yeah.
So there was no mentor. I had mentors, but there was no mentor who lined me up for this position.
Yeah.
And we are known to be not PC. So that's why a lot of people don't stand with us, because we're saying what we need to say. When we need to say.
But you said something very profound. You're following in the tradition of another young man. He didn't want to be a leader. He said, no, I'm not the leader. He was tricked into leadership. He had finished college and he had a little church.
Mm-hmm.
And the older people in the community had been insulted. And they said this, why don't we go get that young boy and make him the leader? Because we don't want to lose our jobs. We don't want to do this.
Yeah,
so they went down to his house, and the young man's name was Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. He was 26 years old. He went there to just pastor his church, and they founded what they call the MIA, Montgomery Improvement Association. And so they went to his house, and they brought him down, and they said, Martin, we're going to start a boycott, and we've elected you as our leader. He said, leader for what? Leader for, because this lady was denied the riding on the bus. So he said, well, what does that mean? So he got involved.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing was a 360-day boycott, and somebody said, well, can you come over here to Georgia? Can you? And he was, like you, he was put into that. He never considered himself
a leader.
The leader.
He was just somebody doing the work.
Doing the work. And so it was that kind of effort mm-hmm. that got, and all of us who went through it, I spent 20 times in jail.
Okay.
But we never saw ourselves as
leaders. I just filed a $5 million lawsuit against the NYPD. I was protesting.
Yeah.
They punched me in the head.
See, all
threw
of
a
that.
Bike on me.
But,
yeah.
But you didn't do it to get pressed.
No.
You did it because it is ethically and morally sound.
Amen.
You know. And so you're in the right mode to do that, and you don't do it for any vainglory.
No.
Because vanities, somewhere I read in the Bible, humble yourself before the almighty hand of God so that God will exalt you. Anytime anybody or any organization exalts mm-hmm. you, they can get rid of you.
Amen.
But if you've been exalted because the cause is greater than you, when everything comes your way, you'll say, uh-huh, and it'll just fall off.
You know what's funny? I'm not moved by much. We work with a couple of celebrities here and there. We sat down with the governor. We negotiated the right for 35,000 parolees to receive a partial pardon.
Wow,
so they
could
vote.
Yeah.
And you know, all this talk doesn't move me. But there's a brother who's coming later this week. His name is DJ Spooky.
Mm-hmm.
I went to his album release party, and he showed me pictures of his father hanging out with Thurgood Marshall. Now, that was something to me.
You know,
he's like, oh, Thurgood Marshall used to come over for beers.
Yeah.
But back to what you were saying about hitting you over the head and taking a seat, that's what I do in New York. A lot of groups, organizations won't touch me because I do not care. I don't care about your mayor. I don't care about your governor. I was quoted in the Times last week. They were talking about Cynthia Nixon, the girl from Sex and the City, is running for governor against Cuomo. And they asked me a question about, well, Cuomo's doing this for the black vote now. And I'm like, I don't care what their motives are as long as they're doing the right thing for the community.
That's it. That's it. And I just came back from San Francisco. We went about elected the first black mayor of San Francisco, female.
Right on.
And now we've got to understand, as I said even here this morning, this is our minute. This is our moment. This is our movement. And you can't back up. You can't bend down. You can't break.
Mm-hmm.
You stand on truth. And when you stand on truth, you can't fail.
That's it.
Now you can get your butt whipped.
Hey.
You can get your head knocked out.
You're listening to a conversation between Hawk Newsom of Black Lives Matter of Greater New York and civil rights veteran, the Reverend Dr. Gerald Durley, recorded at R Day 2018 in Snowmass.
I can't take too much. I got two replaced hips now.
Yeah.
Let those that can do it. And that's what your calling is.
Amen.
But don't do it just to be there. Have a purpose. What made us strong in the movement? Two words. I don't find this in too many of our movements now among those. Two words. Sacrifice and risk.
Mm-hmm.
When you're out there, you're making a sacrifice.
Amen.
When I was at Tennessee State, my senior year, they stripped me of everything. I was a full basketball scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
They stripped everything. The president of the school because I was marching in Nashville.
Really?
I was willing to risk. But now you get somebody, we're going to have a march. They say, I'll be there, but I got a sorority meeting.
That's it.
I got
That's
a fraternity
it.
Meeting. I got to go to it. this meeting. I got to be with 100 black men. No.
Yeah.
What are you willing to sacrifice, and what are you willing to risk?
I don't have to preface this because I'm not a homophobe.
No.
Right?
Yeah.
When a gay black person walks into a room, they don't see a gay person first. They see a black person first.
Right.
And this is why we fight this battle.
Yeah.
Do I show up for transgender women that are killed? Yes.
Yeah.
Do I show up? I'm a board member of the biggest gay activist Democratic club. Yeah.
Yeah.
The fight is real.
You're right.
But let's talk about this. Our movements get co-opted.
Yeah.
Right? Like they join our movement and then try and shift it. Women's March. Islamophobia.
Yeah.
Gay rights. What's the first thing you see on the sign? In racism, then it's like, you know, their cause.
Yeah.
You're always going to see in racism.
Yeah.
But you turn around, and who's showing up for black people? Gay people show up for us.
Yeah.
But outside of that, you look at the Muslim movement, on the Muslim band, we
the
show
Latino.
Up for them. The Latino. People not showing up for us. You know,
and
they kind of, with this president, they kind of left us and forgot about us.
People you know, aren't showing up for you.
Yeah.
No, we're not on the agenda right now. You know who's ahead of us?
Who?
The wall. Immigration,
yeah.
Me Too,
mm-hmm.
You name it, The only discussion minutely about black people is what's going on with the voting rights bill. Mm-hmm. Outside of that, mm-hmm. when we were going through different drug-related illnesses, they wrote two strikes and you're out. Yeah. If you smoke it or if you sell it. Now it's an opioid condition and they're funding it. No difference. It was still drugs.
It was still
you
drugs.
You see, but so matter of who's writing the script. And mm-hmm. right now, we're not in that. So I have to tell people, do not become discouraged because we are simply doing what our role model, Muhammad Ali, did. He did what they call the rope-a-dope. Mm-hmm. I'm in the rope-a-dope right now. Yeah. Black folks are in the rope-a-dope. We're bobbing and we're weaving. But you're not going to knock us out because we're too strong.
That's it.
So you throw this one over there, you throw that, you throw this group, that group. We're bobbing and weaving. Because we've got a resilience stronger than a roach.
Amen.
And when it comes down to it, when the lights come on, we're still going to be out there.
That's it.
And we're going to hit the right blow at the right time. It might come from you. It might come from somebody else. But that's what's going to be so essential. If we don't give up, don't lose hope. Don't and
stay,
that,
the course.
That, stay the course.
Stay the course.
And you're going to always find that opposition. You only know that you're strong when your opposition gets stronger.
Amen.
And if not, then you need to go sit down someplace and take up knitting.
I got a new program I'm launching, right? It's called Rejuvenation.
Yeah.
It's Rejuve-Nation, breathing life back into a deflated people. We're going into the projects
with
mindfulness, meditation, and it's important that I get a Christian person to do the meditation because when we hear meditation, we think voodoo.
Yeah.
We think somebody trying to put a spell on us, right? Clean eating.
Yeah.
We have Dr. Mark Hyman.
Calvin Butch last week.
Okay, you was uptown.
I was uptown.
Yeah,
with
you
Calvin.
Was in Harlem. Yeah, I wish I had known.
Yeah, I was Calvin.
Right on. And so we going into the projects. We're going to give them food, have a DJ there, teach financial literacy, personal organization. So this program, we building up our people to teach them better habits, eating habits. Because what they always fire at me is these Fox conservatives. What about black-on-black crime, right? And I hate that term. I call it violence in the community.
Right.
But I talk about what about food injustice,
right,
which is the most poignant weapon in systematic oppression, because food injustice kills more people than, like 50 times more people than black-on-black crime, so to speak, right? We're talking about diabetes, heart disease,
cholesterol,
hypertension, you name it, and nobody's pointing fingers at these soda companies and these fast food companies for poisoning us.
Yeah.
Now, this is where things might get uncomfortable, right?
Mm-mm.
Because these soda companies, they pay off the significant organizations, right? And then, you know, your silence is kind of there. So I'm putting them in my scope. Like I told you, I have nothing to lose but my chains, like Asada Shakur said.
I have nothing
to lose but my chains. If they really want black people talking about climate change, then they have to invest in it. Just like they would invest in lobbying to get some sort of a bill they want passed. Just like they would invest in a politician who would embody some of the ideals that are being explained in there today. Why don't you invest in educating our community, right? And I also came here to learn. I believe that there's a lot more about climate change and our planet that I should know about. And me being one voice of the voiceless, this is something I can go back and communicate to my people.
You see, that means a lot to me because, as I said when I was closing out this morning, listen, learn, and leave. Leave with something, learn something, but you can't do that until you listen. The three L's of survival. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to make some remarks. You know the title of my address going to be? Make it plain.
Make it plain.
It ain't, no, make it plain.
Make
Daddy
it plain.
King used to say, if I'm going to get across, I got to make it plain to you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me make it plain. I know all of the fracking, all of the nations rising, all of the CO2, all of the methane. I can quote day by day. But what good is it if I can't make it plain?
Right.
Now, to make it plain is how to get people believing in what you're saying. Daddy King used to say, let's make it plain. And everybody said, well, doctor, let's make it plain. Plain means that I'm only as good as you.
Yeah.
And you're only as good as me. So when we leave this place, we have a moral. All of this in here is about a moral discussion.
Amen.
And the capitalism that runs this country is killing off the moral structure. And until we kill that off, that's wrong. No, we don't kill off anything. I believe in rechanneling.
Amen.
If you look at a village and water's coming into a village, rushing in, everybody say, it's a flood. It's water. But if you take that same water and you put parameters around it and you discipline it, it's called irrigation. We
right
need
on.
Irrigation. Don't get rid of the water. Let's
channel
it.
Let's
That's what you're talking about, the funding.
Mm-hmm.
No. Come on, Aflac. Come on, Rockefeller Farm. Let's channel it so that crops can grow, so that people can prosper, so that parity is reality in a country that claims to have equality.
You've been listening to a conversation between Hawk Newsom of Black Lives Matter of Greater New York and civil rights veteran, the Reverend Dr. Gerald Durley, recorded at Our Day 2018. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh.
Thank you, Amy, for the compelling content. Coming up next, we hear from KDNK's Luke Nessler interviewing Brownout's Beto Martinez before their performance tomorrow night at Belly Up Aspen. But first, here's another track from Brownout. This one's off of their 2012 album, Uzi. We'll be right back. That was Meter Beater off of Brownout's 2012 album Uzi. Brownout is playing at the Belly Up Aspen tomorrow night. And KDNK's Luke Nessler spoke with Beto Martinez, who is a founding member and guitarist for the Austin-based Latin funk band. And they spoke about the band's newest album, which is called Fear of a Brown Planet.
Beto Martinez joins the show now. Welcome, Beto.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're so welcome. You're part of Brownout. In fact, you're one of the founding members of Brownout, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
How did Brownout get going? How did that all happen?
Yeah, so Brownout got together around 2003. We were all members of another band called Grupo Fantasma, which is more kind of a Latin band. And I guess I should take it back a little further. Just before we put Grupo Fantasma together in 2000, we all kind of played together in a couple different bands, but would sometimes join forces as this sort of funk party band for just certain occasions, and really had a lot of fun playing that type of music. In 2000, we started this band, Grupo Fantasma, which was more straight-ahead Latin stuff, from cumbia to salsa and stuff. And that band quickly got very busy, and we started touring a whole bunch and really just devoting the majority of our time to that. So a few years down the road, after doing that for a bit, we decided that we missed playing, you know, funk and Latin funk, if you will. So we decided to just put a project together. It was many of the same dudes. We decided to get this project together just to play some of our favorite songs from, you know, stuff like the JBs and Mandrill. And that was in 2003, like I said. And we started doing shows here and there, basically in the off times when Grupo Fantasma wasn't touring. And it went on like that for about 5 years till we put out our first record in 2008 and then really started putting more time into it.
Uh-huh. Is Grupo Fantasma still touring and recording?
Yes, actually. We don't tour as much as we used to, mainly because people are involved in so many other projects at this point. You know, Grupo Fantasma is nearly 20 years old now. But we are actually just wrapping a brand new record that we'll have out early next year.
Oh, that's good news. I remember Grupo Fantasma when it first hit KDNK. Everybody jumped all over it. Really good stuff. And it was the same thing with Brownout. That first one that we got by you guys, I think, was probably Aquilas and y Cobras, 2009.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking because you're about to visit our valley. You're playing the Belly Up on Saturday night, and you're touring behind the release of a brand new album called Fear of a Brown Planet, which is loosely based on a lot of Public Enemy music. What attracted you to Public Enemy, and what is it about their music that made you sit up and go, we need to do that?
Well, we're all fans, obviously, but this record was actually sort of a commission from Fat Beats Records, which is a record label that put it out. They have a history of doing some records, notably one with L. Michaels Affair some years back, where they had them do an instrumental record of a version of Wu-Tang's Enter the 36 Chambers. So they did that record in their style instrumentally. and like I said, they have a history of doing that. So they approached us. We were on tour, actually, with another project that we recently did, Brownout Presents Brown Sabbath. And funnily enough, we were sort of starting to wind down the whole Brown Sabbath thing. That was sort of an unexpected success for us. Was supposed to be a one-off show. Ended up, we did two records, and we ended up touring it for about 3 years. But just as we were kind of getting ready to put that to bed, we had just finished working on an EP called Over the Covers, which was a not not so subtle kind of jab at doing the whole covers thing with the Sabbath. But right as we were doing that, we're on one of our last tours with Brown Sabbath. We get approached by this record label, Fat Beats, in L.A. at the show we did there at the Roxy. And they approach us with this idea of doing this record of Public Enemy instrumentals in our style and just interpreting them. And it really sounded like a lot of fun, like something we couldn't pass up. It was a good challenge, so we decided to do it.
Well, what specifically about Public Enemy's music attracted you as a Latin funk band?
Yeah, so if you break down the music, you know, Public Enemy, those songs and the way they were put together production-wise, it's just super dense. I mean, it's samples on top of samples, and that was sort of them pushing the technology that they had at the time, both technically and creatively. And as a band, we kind of had to break down what those individual samples were. And ultimately, they come down to music that inspired us from the beginning, which is, you know, James Brown, the JBs, Kool and the Gang, Mandrill, just that whole range of, like, 60s and 70s funk that we're huge fans of and that have always been an inspiration to us. So, although it was a challenge to put together, it was ultimately recreating music that we love.
Well, there's no precious little vocals on Fear of a Brown Planet. There's no rapping. So I'm wondering how I'm wondering how you channeled the rage and the political viewpoint of Public Enemy into funk instrumentals. How did you even think of that, or were you approaching it all from a technical standpoint, as you just mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's there, I think. With the original Public Enemy material, yes, it's driven by the lyric, and they're definitely making strong and powerful statements, which are totally relevant today. We didn't have the lyric to get behind, but I think the music, in a lot of ways, as frantic and kind of kinetic that it is, still can kind of get that sentiment across. And while we didn't particularly set out to make any particular statements like that, you know, I think that the title alone in this day and age speaks for itself, and it's if it gets anybody to think or starts any sort of conversations regarding, you know, present day politics or sort of the things we have going on in our society, then we're all for that. But really, we were inspired by the music, and we just tried to recreate the feeling there that those original records brought.
Well, I'm curious how you turned, for instance, all of that dense sampling into a horn chart. Did that happen right away? Did it unspool itself in the studio? How did that whole process work?
Yeah, so it was a little different for each song. I mean, some of the tunes actually, you know, had horns in there that they were able to pull out and make arrangements out of. Others, we kind of had to add stuff to it. And we have a ranger and trombone player, Mark Speedy Gonzalez, who's just super skilled and super talented at being able to do stuff like that. For some of those songs, because we didn't have a vocal and we intended on playing these things live, you know, we had to make them a little more interesting. Sometimes it's just a groove that's locked in and it goes on for a while. So you got to add some elements. So we did take some liberties and added some melodic elements with horns, that we felt would help propel the song in a live setting and kind of keep people's attention. Some of them were breaking them down to the original samples and more referencing the source material, you know, like not exactly the Public Enemy track, but what they sampled, and then working off of those and pulling those references.
Public Enemy comes from the 1980s, early 90s, up until the early 2000s. Back then, do you remember the first time you heard Public Enemy, and what was the feeling for you? What was it that struck you?
Yeah, so I was actually, in the early 90s, I was super into metal. I was a big metalhead, so I was not too fond at the time, I guess, of hip-hop. I was aware of it, but was just not that interested. One of the first times that I heard Public Enemy was when they collaborated with Anthrax, with the metal band Anthrax, and did Bring the Noise. And I just thought that was super exciting. It was super awesome. It was a great mix of styles, a great mix of bands. And that kind of turned me on to a whole lot of other music. That was just a great track, you know, and it was kind of the best of both worlds for me.
Interesting. I think it was He Got Game that got me into Public Enemy, and what a great reworking they did of For What It's Worth. That was just, that's so classic.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting to me that you said you started off as a metalhead because, of course, one of your previous albums, which you mentioned earlier, was Brown Sabbath.
Yeah.
How about that? I think a lot of people widened their eyes when they saw that, and then even more so when they heard it. Do you still play songs from that album?
We do. It's kind of its own show at this point. We do Brown Sabbath as an exclusive sort of show. We actually just did that last night in Seattle. We're sort of at this point right now where we're wearing, you know, kind of different hats depending on where we're going and what the market sort of is asking for. We are touring the Fear of a Brown Planet record, and that's what we will be doing in Aspen. But there were a couple shows on this run that were Brown Sabbath. And every once in a while, we might throw in a tune or two from that. But it's definitely its own kind of standalone show at this point. Alex Marrero, who does vocals he came into the band for the Brown Sabbath project, and he's a vocalist for that. But now he's in Brownout proper, and he really commits to that show, and it really becomes about that. So It is kind of its own thing.
So I guess next you'll be redoing Pink Floyd?
As Brown Floyd? Yeah.
Brown Floyd. That's pretty funny.
No, yeah. I think it's important to sort of explain, you know, that we've been around for 15 years. We have four records of original material. We kind of got into the Brown Sabbath thing, and like I said earlier, it really met with some success that we weren't expecting, so we ended up doing it for a lot longer than we thought, and we've gained a lot of new fans from it. But we released an EP after those two records of original material before we did this Fear of a Brown Planet, and we've actually just wrapped up a record. We just finished mixing it, produced by Steve Berlin of Los Lobos, that's going to be all brand new original material that will be coming out next year.
Huh. Will you always be an instrumental band, Beto?
No, actually, with the addition of Alex Marrero, like I said, he's singing lead with us now.
Oh.
And we have incorporated some songs that feature that on this tour. But this new record, I think, will be something new for everyone as we showcase lead vocals for the first time with Brownout.
So maybe delving back a little bit more into the Mexican heritage of music, or is it totally modern?
You know, it's a mix of a lot of things. So it's pretty modern, but you know, we draw heavily on our influences. So I don't know. I guess we'll just have to see.
Okay. Your band is a big band. How many? 9 members in your band?
Yes, we are 9 members. We're actually touring with 10 now because we have a very good friend of ours and collaborator, Peter Stopshinsky, on keys, who is facilitating a lot of the, you know, organ and synth work or the Brown Planet stuff.
Talk a little bit about your band. Do they all come from the Grupo Fantasma days, or did some of them come in later than that?
Most of them do. So, like, our core horn section and rhythm section, for the most part, are all from Grupo Fantasma. We have Adrian Quesada, who's one of the co-founders with myself, and Greg Gonzalez, who plays bass. Adrian Quesada was also a co-founder of Grupo Fantasma, but he left Grupo Fantasma about 5 years ago now. So he's actually not in Fantasma. He's one of the few. I'm trying to think who else. Obviously, Peter, who was touring with us on keys, he's not really a permanent member of either band, but he's helping us out for this tour. And Alex Marrero has never been in Grupo Fantasma, but he's in Brownout now. So. Okay. So I guess for the most part, like 8 out of the 9.
That's a daunting thing to take 10 people out on the road. It's like a logistical challenge every single day. Or is it? Is it easy? You probably have it down by now.
Well, yeah, we've been doing it for a long time. Like I said, I mean, considering our work with Grupo Fantasma, we've been on the road for almost 20 years at this point. It's definitely challenging. And a lot of that has to do with logistics and sort of the financial aspect of it all. It costs a lot of money to keep a big band on the road, but you know, we make it work, and it's worth it, I think, for the fans and for ourselves to really be able to get the sound that we want to get. You know, this is the way that we do it. It's the way we know how to do it. So that's what we're doing.
Well, Beto Martinez, I want to thank you so much for joining us for a few minutes talking about Brownout. You have a lot of people positively drooling over your Saturday night visit to our valley. So it's going to be fun. We'll look forward to seeing you.
Thank you very much. We are super excited to get out there, and we look forward to the show.
All right, Beto. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Express Yourself. I'm Raleigh Burley, taking the reins for today's show. And you're listening now to Lamento en la Selva, which means Anguish in the Jungle, by Money Chicha. This band, Money Chicha, is opening for Brownout tomorrow night at the Belly Up starting at 9:30 and features members of Brownout. They play chicha music, which is a fuzzed-out, reverb-drenched, and percussion-heavy style of music from Peru and Colombia, called cumbia, known for its psychedelic surf guitar, pyrotechnics, and melodies influenced by the indigenous culture of the Andes Mountains. And as of now, there still are tickets available for the show. Very modestly priced, I must say. It is a Friday night, and there's more going on in the Roaring Fork Valley. Begin a new gallery and store on Main Street in Carbondale called DJ's. Has an artist reception beginning at 6 p.m. Ashley Caudill plays some soulful music at Steve's Guitars tonight. Lainey Lou and the Bird Dogs will be hanging out at Steve's Guitars tomorrow night. At the Belly Up tonight is Lost Kings with special guests. On Monday is SNBRN, Sunburn. Tuesday is G-Love and the Special Sauce. And on Wednesday and Thursday, Thievery Corporation play again at the Belly Up Aspen. There will be some reggae tonight at the Temporary. Tatanka is taking the stage tomorrow night. Wilder Miss with the Still Tide, which is pop rock. At the Ute Theater, a band from The West Coast Yak Attack is playing. Thunder River Theater is presenting Yankee Tavern. That is tonight and tomorrow. Last chances to check out that play all about 9/11 conspiracies taking place in a bar in New York. There's a great review of that in the latest edition of the Soper Sun. It contains four actors, very talented, and it's a fantastic show. Valle Musico play at Rivers Restaurant at 8:30 tonight. The Glenwood Brew Garden presents DJ Running Man at 9:15. And Indigo Mojo is playing at Marble Distilling tonight at 7. The town of Carbondale and the Carbondale Creative District are inviting people to participate in the Carbondale Affordable Creative Space Survey, and that is aimed at understanding affordable housing needs for Carbondale's creative community. It is available at carbondaleaffordablecreativespacesurvey.org until August 6th, and will help determine whether or not building a new space for studios and housing geared towards artists is something that is in demand here in the community of Carbondale. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Express Yourself. My name is Raleigh Burley, wishing everyone a bright and expressive weekend. Don't forget that the world craves your expression. We will go out with one more track off of Money Chicha's album Hecho en México, Made in Mexico. This is called Quieren Efectos, which means they want effects, don't we all? Stay tuned for the local news coming up at 5:34. Have a wonderful weekend. Stay tuned to KDNK.